Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. We will get started in just a few minutes. Hello, thank you for joining us today. We will get started in just a minute. All right. Hello, my name is Paul Bierman, Director of Education and Events for SNED. Welcome to today's Journal of Nutrition, Education, and Behavior Journal Club webinar, the last in a series of 11 webinars with a focus on nutrition education programs and implications from the field. Special thank you to the SNED Food and Nutrition Extension Education Division for helping select articles from the journal showcasing the work of cooperative extension nutrition educators. As the official peer-reviewed journal of the Society for Nutrition Education and Behavior, JNEB advances nutrition education and behavior-related research, practice, and policy. Before we begin, I'd like to review a few pieces of information. We will take questions at the end of the presentation. Throughout the presentation, please type any questions you may have into the Q&A box, and they will be moderated out to our panelists. When the webinar ends today, you'll be prompted to complete a short survey. Please take a moment to complete this, as your feedback is greatly appreciated for future SNEB webinars. This webinar is being recorded and will be available free of charge to SNEB members in the webinar section of the website. Finally, watch for a follow-up email to be sent in the next few days, which will include a link to the recording for this session, the handouts, and your CEU certificate for your attendance today. I will now hand things over to our moderator, Dr. Kristen DiFilippo, teaching assistant professor at the University of Illinois.
Thank you.
Kristen?
Thank you, Paul. We have three speakers today. Dr. Shanee Jones is an assistant professor of clinical pediatrics in the Division of General Pediatrics at the University of Miami Holt Children's Hospital. She's completed her pediatrics residency at Johns Hopkins and fellowship in academic general pediatrics at Vanderbilt University. Her current role consists of providing clinical care to pediatric patients in the outpatient and newborn nursery settings, as well as teaching primary care pediatrics to residents and medical students. Kimberly Bonnet is the senior scientist for the Qualitative Research Core at Vanderbilt University. She has a master's degree in psychology. David Schlund is an associate professor of psychology at Vanderbilt University. He received his PhD in clinical psychology at Indiana University in 1982 and received further postdoc training at University of Mississippi Medical Center. With over 40 years of research experience, he has authored or co-authored over 280 papers in peer-reviewed journals. He is trained as a clinical health psychologist and has been studying the assessment and modification of health behaviors for the past 35 years, has 25 years of experience with health disparities and 20 years with community-based participatory research. His work has included diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular disease, and asthma. He directs the Qualitative Research Core for the Vanderbilt Institute of Medicine and Public Health. The Qualitative Core supports investigators doing qualitative and mixed method studies. He works with the Community Outreach Core of the Meharry Vanderbilt Tennessee State University Cancer Partnership. He is an original investigator with the Southern Community Cohort Study, and he has extensive experience using qualitative and quantitative methods for research on health behavior. I want to thank the three of them for being here with us today and sharing their expertise with us. At this point, I can pass it over to our presenters.
Thank you so much for that introduction, Dr. DiFilippo. So as the title shows, today's talk will be about Head Start's role in addressing food and nutrition insecurity and focus group findings. As Dr. DiFilippo said or mentioned, I'm currently at the University of Miami, but I did this work along with Ms. Bonnet and Dr. Schlund when I was a fellow at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. So the nutrition educator competencies that this presentation will be covering today include one within food and nutrition policy, having to do with collaboration with community members to make sure that there are settings in which healthy foods are more easy and affordable. And then there's the second competency of nutrition education program design, implementation, evaluation, specifically as it relates to the participatory research approaches that allow for target populations to communicate their experiences, which is what this presentation focused on. We have nothing to disclose today. So to start off with the background and the definition of food insecurity, what is it? Specifically, it's defined as limited or uncertain access to adequate, safe, and acceptable foods due to financial resource constraints. A protective factor against food insecurity is child participation in Head Start, which is a federally funded program in the US promoting school readiness for preschool-aged children and low-income families by offering comprehensive educational, nutritional, health, and social services at no cost. The prevalence of food insecurity among Head Start enrolled families is twice that of the national average of households with children. Food insecure children have lower overall diet quality with fewer greens and higher added sugar intake compared to those children that are food secure. And so therefore, food insecure children may also be nutrition insecure, meaning having inconsistent access to sufficient nutritious food, and which meet dietary needs for an active and healthy life. So children in Head Start are therefore at higher risk of being food and nutrition insecure than those not in Head Start due to to many of the participants living in households with incomes at or below the poverty level. So Head Start addresses food and nutrition insecurity, or FNI, at the individual level by providing free, high quality breakfast and lunch, nutrition education, and assisting families to enroll in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, or the Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infant, and Children, or WIC. But provision of food alone may not be sufficient means to maintain adequate nutrition status, and thus it's important to call attention to nutrition security. It's been shown in studies that poverty can lead to decreased access to nutrition whole food, which can cause those affected to opt for low-cost foods that are high in fat and carbohydrates. And so that type of diet lacks essential vitamins and minerals, which is associated with poor physical and cognitive growth and development for children. And so the implications of that are especially significant during the preschool age, which Head Start children fall under. Because details on experiences of Head Start families related to FNI, as well as Head Start employees who interface directly with them, are limited in the literature, we aim to elicit Head Start families' employees' perspectives on family experiences with FNI, and then identify how Head Start contributes to addressing them. So our study sample consisted of the Head Start program of Nashville and Davidson County, which provides free preschool and pre-K education to income eligible families with children ages 3 to 5 years old in Nashville, Davidson County, Tennessee. And so just as a more specific example, for a household of four to be eligible to enroll in Head Start in Tennessee, the maximum annual household income must be about $28,000 before taxes. In total, there are 7 Head Start centers and 3 partner sites throughout Nashville, and the program is the largest provider of early childhood education in the county. In this study, we conducted 4 focus groups, 3 with 19 Head Start parents or guardians, and 1 with 8 Head Start employees. Eligible parents or guardians were those whose children attended a Head Start center in Davidson County, Tennessee, who spoke English or Spanish as a primary language and were at least 18 years old and were willing to participate in a virtual focus group. So all of the recruitment was virtual in the setting of the COVID-19 pandemic and occurred from August 2021 to January 2022. And then eligible Head Start employees primarily included employees responsible for family engagement, including Head Start family advocates and parent engagement coordinators. So the Nashville Collaborative is an academic community partnership of over a decade between the Vanderbilt Department of Pediatrics and 15 community organizations, including Head Start, with goals to improve family health and reduce health disparities. And so therefore, there was an already established relationship between the institution and Head Start leaders. So leveraging these relationships, Head Start employees whose role directly involved working with families helped identify other employees interested in participating. It's important to note that neither the Head Start director nor other directors were involved in this recruitment process. Then all employees were English speaking and received a token equivalent up to $20, since the Head Start policy, at least at this center in Davidson County, prevented other forms of compensation. And then Head Start employees recruited family participants on the Head Start listserv, as well as through recruitment flyers placed at Head Start centers by Key City personnel and via telephone and text messages. Then Key City personnel, including myself, also recruited family participants during virtual Head Start events and presentations, for example, on nutrition that would occur from time to time. And then prior to the actual focus group, personnel oriented families to the virtual platform, and each family participant received a $20 gift card for participating in the focus group. So this was a qualitative study through focus group discussion. All 4 focus groups were held virtually via Zoom platform. And each focus group consisted of 4 to 8 participants based on guidance from established texts on the ideal focus group size for non-commercial topics. So we sought to recruit about 10 participants at most per focus group, which lasted about an hour and recorded via teleconference platform. An experienced facilitator from Vanderbilt's Qualitative Research Corps moderated focus groups using a semi-structured interview guide. The interview guide was developed to answer a wide range of questions about the constructs of FNI as it related to Head Start families. And then, you know, it was reviewed by the entire team before being agreed upon the final version. And the overall goal of the interview guide was to obtain descriptive narratives of how families interact with Head Start around the issue of food and nutrition insecurity, the barriers that families face in feeding children, and the strategies used by Head Start staff to provide nutrition, education, and assistance to families. And so the audio recording of these focus groups was then transcribed using an IRB-approved commercial service, and then transcripts were reviewed and identifying info was removed. So Questions in the Head Start employee focus group prompted elaboration on the current processes of food insecurity and nutrition insecurity screening and views on the food-related and nutritional needs of families. So here were some example questions. They included, how do you currently refer Head Start families to food-related community resources, and how do you stay up to date with them, whether they are local or national resources? What's the greatest barrier in Head Start, in the employee's opinion, for Head Start families to consistently obtain healthy food, and how do you work with families to overcome the barrier? And then we asked a general question of what other important food and nutrition related needs are there for Head Start families. And this wasn't that was not an exhaustive list, and neither is the next, just some example questions. So for the Head Start family focus groups, we elicited views on their experiences related to food and nutrition security and Head Start. So similarly, we ask, what's the greatest challenge with consistently obtaining healthy foods for your family? How does Head Start work with you to overcome them? What works well and what could be improved? Do you use resources recommended? And if so, which ones are the most helpful? And then once again, the general follow-up question of what other important food and nutrition-related needs do you have? And so as far as the data coding and analysis goes, so there was use of one focus group. And from that one focus group, a hierarchical coding system was developed using an iterative, inductive, deductive approach. So deductively, the coding system was guided by a few different theories, one being the social cognitive theory, the theory of planned behavior, and the social ecological model. While inductively, the sample transcript was used to create subcategories and to fill in the details. And so to establish reliability of coding, two coders coded each focus group and reconciled any differences after discussion. And there weren't any discrepancy that the two coders were unable to agree upon. And so the reconciled files were used for analysis. And so once all the transcripts were coded, the research team met and agreed that thematic saturation had been achieved. And so coders, exported the codes into SPSS, and then codes were replaced by text, and then sorted records, coders sorted records by code and exported them to Excel for analysis. And so the process of qualitative analysis consisted of identifying categories and then the relationships between those categories. And then finally, a conceptual framework was identified or created, and that was an iterative process informed deductively by the theories that I mentioned, and then inductively instantiated by the coded quotes. And so quotes were identified and then used to illustrate the concepts in this conceptual framework, which I'll go over in the next slide. It's an image that I'll break down, little by little. So the left side of the figure. So here's the conceptual framework, a summary of that in the form of a figure. So the left side of the figure represents the ecological context in which Head Starts and families operate. So we identified important domains at various levels, from the micro to the macro here. So from social network, neighborhood, community, public policy, and then society and culture at large. And then the right side, the general right side of this this conceptual framework shows the Head Start caregivers and children embedded within the Head Start program. And so the label emphasizes that the framework is focused on F&I of caregivers and children. And there were four general categories, as you can see in pink, identified to better understand the interactions of caregivers and children with their food environment. So that was dietary practices, that was one of them. And that included the food choices and eating habits of the family. Second was resources, which really referred to work, finances, childcare, and other tangible resources. Then there were knowledge and beliefs, which included knowledge of nutrition, for example, and self-efficacy beliefs. And then there's family composition, which, as the name suggests, the number and ages of adults and children in the household. And then the circle with the arrows, I think you can see my mouse. The circle with the arrows represents the dynamic interactions of these factors as they influence F&I at the household level. And then now the outer ring, the gray ring, represents the Head Start program with its policies, its practices, and resources. So we identified in green four additional categories to describe how the Head Start environment affects family food and nutrition insecurity. So one was resources and processes, next was advocacy, communication, and nutrition education. And so they are also connected with circular errors to represent that Head Start is a dynamic system with lots of interacting components. And finally, the two arrows, the two blue arrows labeled barriers and facilitators, represent, you know, barriers and facilitators that are important influences on food and nutrition insecurity. So as I mentioned, ecological modifiers in yellow are thought of as environmental systems in which Head Start and its families live and go to school. So we identify five levels, as I mentioned, from micro to macro. And so for just to give a background before I go into the specific quote having to do with society and culture, about the other ecological modifiers, the social network category really referred to caregivers relying on their networks, including family and friends, in order to provide help with enough healthy food in the household. Then discussions of the neighborhood level really centered on proximity to stores and where foods could be purchased and discussion of alternative resources. Then there is the community level at the community level, there are resources that Head Start employees use to make referrals and that participants noted as ways to overcome food deserts. Then there's the policy level, which really focused on ways for local government to act to bring about more healthy options to areas in need. And then finally was a society cultural level. And an employee in the quote above discussed what she called generational cycles that help sustain poverty as needing to be addressed by Head Start. So this quote, as you can see, it mentions that previous generations of families, you know, didn't have the opportunity to provide healthy food or to make healthy choices, and that therefore propagates into the next generation, and that learned behavior goes on to the subsequent generation. So this employee was explaining that she feels that a lot of that is breaking down that barrier so that the next generation is more informed. And I thought that what was interesting was the mention of, you know, at first, perhaps because this information is new, perhaps they might not trust what they, you know, what is new information compared to what has been known. So of course, we will talk about it in the next few slides about the family advocate and how building that trust helps overcome those generational cycles. So next is the category of advocacy. And so in Head Start, that's two meetings. There's the actions and actual specific staff who work to advocate. So advocacy occurs when Head Start staff take action to assist or benefit families, such as interfacing with social service programs. So Head Start family advocates specifically conduct advocacy work. And so there is an emphasis on the importance of the having a family advocate that is in regular contact with families, who builds trust and allows families to ask for help if it's needed. So that's what the second quote refers to, you know, consistent contact, fostered evolution of the role into friendship for some caregivers even. So the second quote talks about how at first some families might be more guarded about their feelings and what's going on in their household and aren't ready to share. But as time goes on and as trust is built, then they begin to share more with their advocate. And then families also noted that the family advocate inquired about family needs, even without families asking for help first, which is great. Parents specifically mentioned that their family advocates were the ones in Head Start who provided information about resources and support and navigation of services, which is what the first quote from a family participant mentions, that the advocate is the one who is asking what families' needs are and making sure that, you know, they can provide help. So next is the category, you know, I wanted to highlight the category of Head Start resources and processes. So the ability of the local Head Start program to reduce food and nutrition insecurity is really influenced by the policies and the resources of the local Head Start, as well as the larger organization. So Head Start has policies and procedures around feeding children, such as working with children reluctant to try foods. That came out of our discussions. One important area a policy is to offer referrals to patients or to parents, excuse me, with needs that can't be met with HESTA resources. So they, if there's a need that cannot be met with internal Head Start resources, there's the already established policy to refer externally. And then after that, in addition to referring externally, there are policies such as going with the parent when they're looking for a new resource, and advocates and other employees were noted to follow up with parents in a timely manner to see if the referral was successful, and to follow up on a regular basis to make sure that the family situation has not changed, because of course, you know, that food insecurity is episodic and a dynamic process. So these were all the policies and processes in place to help offset food and nutrition insecurity. This quote actually shows that there were non-food services that had started to assist with, such as increasing discretionary income through helping to helping families pay their utility bills, through rental assistance, and through finding a job. So they also assist with those services, which can directly impact food and nutrition security by increasing discretionary income. Then there's the last couple of categories I wanted to highlight through quotes was the communication category, which touches upon that delivering services to families really requires communication between staff and clients in many different methods. So some methods that were mentioned included written communications home to caregivers, in-person meetings, bulletin boards, phone calls, and emails. And to match services with needs, Head Start routinely conducts needs assessments, include specifically related to FNI and participation in SNAP upon enrollment, which this quote exemplifies. And then Head Start also conducts, you know, regular checkups using questionnaires to assess needs even after the initial enrollment. And then finally, there's the nutrition education component, which Head Start provides. Some examples that were mentioned included education to families on shopping for and preparing healthy foods. They at one point would offer grocery store tours to help them become healthier shoppers, which is what this quote is explaining. And then there are also hands-on cooking demonstrations for parents too. And so nutrition education needs that were identified included how to plan and prepare meals on a budget, as well as appropriate portion sizes. So some points of discussion I wanted to point out specifically from the focus groups. One included the point about generational cycles of learned behaviors and how they contribute to ongoing choices. So that observed behaviors, of course, socioeconomic status, culture, social context, and stress all influence these cycles. And the dietary practices category of the framework really touched upon that too, which shape, you know, what factors shape family eating habits and choices. And so Head Start can actually use these, you know, the deep-rooted relationships that they develop over time to shape and impart new knowledge on Head Start families so that the default decision is the healthiest. And so while education is already integrated in the Head Start approach for both children and primary caregivers, there are certain educational topics which focus groups results from the focus group emphasize, which include how to shop for healthy foods on a budget. Another educational component recommended was maybe a group tasting event, for parents to try new foods in a social setting, and then targeting the knowledge gap on fundamentals, like what foods are considered healthy, like very specifically. Then next, you know, in order for Head Start to really effectively facilitate the numerous components utilized to address food and nutrition insecurity, there really must be a point person for coordination. And the family advocate in Head Start is a change agent who does this, who integrates all the components and performs this role. And so advocates aid the Head Start director in identifying families in need of social services and implementing program activities to meet the needs. And so they share a list of community resources among themselves to increase their capacity. And although not really stated in their explicitly in their job description, they regularly follow up with families. So they foster a safe space for Head Start parents and families to make sure that there's a culture of trust, so that parents feel comfortable enough to disclose areas of need or even knowledge gaps. So this study and, you know, the results in the study really highlight the importance of family advocates personalized to family needs but also localized to the community in order to address F&I. And then, you know, Head Start is very focused on a two-generational approach with interventions. And so that means for both children and parents, focusing on both generations. And so, you know, research indicates that there is a strong influence of parental food preference on child behaviors and dietary behaviors, and that, you know, these childhood food behaviors really significantly track into adulthood. So Head Start really uses multi-component child and parent interventions for greater impact. And, you know, Head Start routinely assesses parental needs surrounding food and addresses them through internal means via supplementary foods or external referrals to community resources. And Head Start employees work with families to connect them to existing resources and enroll them in federal programs too. And then access to nutrition food alone is not sufficient in maintaining the optimal level of food and nutrition security. Families must learn skills for a nutritious lifestyle too. So that was represented by the nutrition education category in the conceptual framework. So when I, you know, skill building really consists of learning, applying new skills, which is a regular part of Head Start parents and child education. Prior to the pandemic, Head Start led outings to grocery stores to teach parents how to shop healthier, which also addressed nutrition insecurity. And then Head Start promotes optimal nutrition in child participants by introducing them to new healthy foods while at school, which even that has a benefit in reducing spending, parental spending on excess foods to accommodate picky eaters. And then parents actually even noted that Head Start helped them learn strategies to increase their child's acceptance of nutritious foods, which is, of course, really important in this age of preschoolers. And so, and then finally was the point that I mentioned before of assistance via non-food related needs, such as helping parents with utility bills and job skills training programs. And so by supporting families and securing a stable job, for example, Head Start facilitates an increase in family discretionary income, helping to circumvent poverty and placing them in a better position to obtain consistent access to nutritious foods. So as far as implications for research and practice, this study really highlights the unique position of Head Start and any other program that reaches underserved preschool age children and their primary caregivers in improving the food and nutrition security of family participants. And, you know, while access can make a difference in decreasing food insecurity for Head Start families, this study really shows that families require skills building to increase nutrition security as well. Therefore, Head Start should, you know, increase emphasis on improving families' ability to select healthy foods, plan and budget for healthy meals, and prepare foods healthily. And then healthy eating habits can then at that point become the default choice, which is then passed from caregivers to children for a greater impact. And so through, you know, two-generation multi-level approaches that disrupt generational cycles of unhealthy food behaviors, then families can learn skills to improve their nutrition, which can offset the negative effects of F&I. Then, of course, there's the role of the family advocate who has a personal relationship with families and extensive knowledge of the community. And that's key because advocates link families to both resources and skills for a nutritious lifestyle. So a similar structure can be used for future interventions targeting families with young children who experience F&I at high rates. And perhaps future research can then assess the impact of these interventions, which work simultaneously to improve both elements. For me, as a pediatrician in an academic center, you know, I make sure that I familiarize trainees with Head Start as well as parents as much as I can, especially those new to the country who are not familiar, since I know of the multiple positive outcomes of optimizing children's health and nutrition. And personally, you know, even through training, I knew of Head Start as a place for preschool, you know, and, you know, school readiness in that regard, but I don't think I was fully informed of the multi, you know, component approach and the huge impact they focus on or they that happens because of the multiple aspects that they help with. So, and of course, preventing food and nutrition insecurity has such a profound impact because, you know, we know that food and nutrition insecurity is has a range of negative health outcomes, whether it be mental health, physical health, increased risk of infections and other chronic conditions. So this prevention through optimal nutrition is really, I really aim to share it amongst trainees and parents who might not have heard of it. And then I want to acknowledge the grant support that allowed this study to take place in the leadership of those at Head Start in Nashville, who collaborated with us throughout the whole project. Head Start was involved throughout the study, entire study, and we made sure to disseminate results to leadership when they became available. And then we also made sure to send them a draft of our paper before submitting it to the journal to make sure to receive their input prior to submission and publication. Here are some of my references, and I put in a couple more additional slides about a couple studies that have come about since my original literature review that has to do with Head Start families. I'll just go over them really briefly before taking questions. So one came out of the Journal for Ecology of Food and Nutrition from Nationwide Children's Hospital. And the study explored perceptions of online grocery shopping and online USDA SNAP electronic benefit transfer card program among Head Start caregivers, and perceived benefits that came out of it included saving time, preventing impulse buys, and eating healthier. And so this, you know, has a broad implication, especially since the COVID-19 pandemic, where, you know, grocery shopping and just online electronic forms and virtual forms of, you know, any service, but of course, healthy food services have expanded. And so, you know, I thought it was very interesting that it specifically it questioned or obtained perception from Head Start caregivers specifically, and it was generally accepted by Head Start caregivers, as well as showed benefits of healthier eating choices. And then another one had to do with the feasibility of using Facebook to engage parents who are SNAP eligible and provide education on eating well on a budget, especially since that was one of the topics that came out of our discussions, you know, making sure that we teach this. But, you know, we didn't go into, so this study takes it a step further about ways in which to do so, what platform to do so. And so the results showed that Facebook was a feasible way, or platform for delivering food education information, to delivering interventions of a curriculum, and it was very engaging, and particularly it's helpful for those parents in or Head Start parents living in rural areas. And so this is an area also for future research, exploring the use of social media platforms for delivering nutrition education to rural populations that could be difficult to reach. So I found that very interesting. But yep. So overall, I wanted to thank you for listening to our presentation today, and wanted to see if there are any questions based on our talk.
Yeah, thank you so much. So if people have questions, please put those in the Q&A. The first question is there a specific program or curriculum that is recommended to offer to Head Start families?
Sure. Facebook, the study that I just mentioned, the one that they offered was an already established curriculum through like Sesame Street and through nutrition, like through identified dietitian. So that I thought was interesting, that was one of the you know, preschool child age ones that they use and could be a feasible method as well.
Any other thoughts on that or? Okay, another question I had, can you tell us a little more about the Qualitative Research Corps at Vanderbilt University? I'm not familiar with that program, and it sounded like they were involved. So just give us a better idea of what their setup is. And
so can we get Dr. Schlund and Ms. Bonnick?
Happy to address that. So we came into existence around 2010. That was back when the CTSA grant funding first started to come through. I was working with the Community Outreach Corps, and we asked ourselves the question, what services could we provide to clinical and translational researchers that would really help them boost their research and their productivity? And we came up with supporting qualitative and mixed methods. So many people have that as an element of their research plan, but they lack the skills or the background or depth of experience. The other issue it really helps overcome is you may have a phase one or an aim one that's formative. It's going to last, 9 months or 18 months. And you hire somebody with qualitative experience and then have to hire somebody with different experience. So we got started with that. And in 2013, we became an official core, part of the Health Services Research Group. And essentially, investigators at Vanderbilt Medical Center, Meharry Medical College, and other outside institutions can contact us, say, we've got a project here we'd like you to help us with. We basically understand what their needs are. We can offer anything from just sort of consultation services for somebody who's got a good background to, I don't know anything about qualitative. Well, great, we'll take it on and do the whole thing for you, and either prepare a report or prepare a draft, methods and results for a manuscript. And so we've really worked with a wide range of issues, from working with surgeons to working with developmental disabilities to working with people in the sort of neonatal intensive care or the pediatric intensive care. We've done more sort of community oriented work where we did some analysis of sort of life stories of elders and tried to understand how people thought of themselves as they go into sort of the latter stage of life. So it's been a very interesting journey, and we really, I think, have been able to help a lot of researchers like Shawnee here, where she didn't necessarily have those skills herself. I think she's now better prepared moving forward as an academic pediatrician to know when she can do qualitative work and perhaps be able to do it herself as well. But so we've been doing this for quite some time now, and feel like we've really made a difference in a lot of research programs.
I agree that I really understand the benefit of mixed methods, informing next steps. So I are just in just better understanding the answers to a question that you have clinically.
I would emphasize that our work is really often formative in the sense that it's hypothesis generating, or it's sort of mapping out the area to what are some of the important variables. Again, with this particular study, really understanding that the families are embedded in a community context, I think was an important contribution, and that the expertise of the Head Start, particularly the advocators in navigating those resources, was a very important service that they offered. In a mixed method study, you have say you're doing a clinical trial, you have quantitative outcomes. We can help by interviewing, let's say, a subset of the participants. We did this recently with somebody who's doing a whole foods approach, really introducing families to getting closer to whole foods. Their experiment, they provided meals in boxes, and we came in after they did the quantitative outcomes and talked to the families. And what did you think about it? What worked? What didn't work? What could be done better? So again, it provides, in a mixed method study, it often provides a much richer degree of feedback on your clinical trial or your interventions than you would get just from the results of a food frequency questionnaire.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing that. It's great to learn more about projects and opportunities like that. What is the cultural implication for Head Start families in addressing food insecurity?
Can you elaborate on the question?
It's from someone who is listening in. So maybe if they have a little more.
I'll try to answer to the best of my ability based on what I understand. So as far as, culturally, this is interesting because the WIC program has recently updated what it will, fund basically. And it's going to decrease the amount of sugar substances that it funds from what I gathered. But one thing that I found interesting, which I actually have to read more into, is because it's going to become a little bit more flexible in order to accommodate different cultural preferences, right? So, you know, if there's any like non-dairy substitutes for milk, for example, like plant-based options, I think they're trying to accommodate and make sure they take into account different cultural preferences in food when establishing different requirements and guidelines of federal programs.
Yeah, and I would add that when you talked about sort of the intergenerational transmission of culture, it's a complex issue. The Spanish-speaking families may be sort of recent immigrants from Mexico or Central America. Some of the African-American families in Nashville have very deep family roots and large extended family networks here. The navigating their food environments can be very, very different due to, let's say, cultural preferences around foods, but really to the fact that a new immigrant family has a much different social network and cultural affiliation than, let's say, an African American family whose roots go back to before the Civil War in Tennessee. So I think there's a lot of elements to this cultural part, but again, to me, the real importance is just listening. Listening to people, listening to families, and then really meeting people where they are.
Yes. Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth. Yes, exactly. When even in the clinic, when making recommendations and discussing with families, I'm really listening to what their day-to-day dietary choices are and their food environment is, and then coming up with a solution to even one change that's more healthy together, that's truly feasible and that's, in line culturally with their practices.
Thank you. And that person who asked the question said, yes, thank you. You've addressed it. So I appreciate the follow-up. Another listener says, great presentation. SNAP benefits typically do not last the month. So how do these families follow the guidance given? And were some of the staff eligible for SNAP or other forms of assistance?
I mean, I personally can't answer the last part, whether the employees were eligible, because they didn't specifically ask that. So I'm not certain of that question.
There were lots of strategies for helping the families make it through the end of the month. Mm-hmm. So pre-COVID, there are several food banks that families can be sent to pick up a box of food to help them make it through the month. I recall a discussion around how they dealt with that during the pandemic. They would deliver sometimes the advocates a box of food to a family, or they would arrange a pickup at a church or another sort of local spot. There was a lot of sensitivity to that issue, and I think a variety of strategies. Maybe you can remember some more than I can from that.
No, the food delivery was definitely a big part. I remember even when I got to Nashville, they had, that was a regular part of their practices at that local Head Start that I would go to, would be to have, whether it be daily or weekly, I can't remember, but disseminating information to families about pickup of foods in between.
Thank you so much. Well, I want to thank you all for being here today and sharing a wonderful presentation with us. At this point, I can hand it back to Paul.
Thank you. And also special thank you, Kristen, for organizing the Journal Club. This is our 22nd semester. Thank you as well to all of our panelists today for taking your time to come here and share with us. For all the folks participating in the call, just a recap of those reminders I had at the beginning. Do please complete that survey that you'll receive when we close out today's session. We do appreciate your feedback. Be on the lookout for an email with today's recording, handouts, and your CEU certificate. And if you enjoyed today's webinar, be sure to check out the upcoming webinars section of the website while the Journal Club is finished after today. We do have some different division-sponsored webinars that are coming up through May and June. With that, brings us to the close. I hope you all have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.